Well, good evening, everybody, and thank you very much for coming along tonight. It's great to see you all, really. And I feel obliged to thank all members of Shavit Palestine Campaign who worked hard. I don't want to name names, everybody who worked hard with us on preparing for this meeting, because it's such an important meeting. Our guest tonight is Professor Jeff Halper, who I'm going to introduce later. In a very short time, don't worry. I wouldn't bore you with long introductory speech. But we meet tonight when the situation is still the same. But the difference is that the world is not paying any attention because people are not being killed on big scale in Palestine, in the Gaza Strip. The world has turned a blind eye as always, and that's why our meeting tonight is extremely important. The facts on the ground are shocking. What's happening in the Gaza Strip is a crime, a war crime by definition of international law, and the world is not paying attention. That's why when we say we need people's efforts to help us raise awareness and bring a change in the long run for people of Palestine and people of the Gaza Strip who are suffering, who are being in what I call a concentration camp that is imposed on them by the Israeli state, and unfortunately nobody is helping them but people like you and us, and we should continue to help them. We meet in a week when Bishop Desmond Tutu has given an interview to Haaretz, Akifa Aldar, a correspondent or writer, in which he called openly for sanctioning of Israel, imposing sanctions against Israel. The article is here with me for people to see if they wish. But Desmond Tutu is saying the world at the beginning, when people imposed boycott on the apartheid regime in South Africa, said nothing will happen, but eventually, behind closed doors, all what the South African apartheid regime leaders wanted from the ANC leaders is that to stop the boycott because it was biting. Let's work together on making the boycott bite the aggressive Israeli state, and hopefully one day, gradually, let's not hope for an immediate victory, but one day this will pay because, you know, right must prevail, justice must prevail. I just want to say that for people who are fasting, first of all, Ramadan Mubarak, Ramadan Kareem, and we prepared for dates and orange juice at the reception. So please, whenever it's time for breakfasting, help yourselves for dates and orange juice. And once again, Ramadan Mubarak. And without any more delay, Jeff Halper is with us tonight. We are so honored to have him. An exceptional man of great courage who works hard for people who are in need of justice, who puts his body against bulldozers to stop demolition of people's houses, who pledged to build every single house that was demolished by the Israelis. And we are honored to have him in Sheffield here tonight. And without any further delay, Jeff Halper.
Well, thanks for inviting me to Sheffield. Rearrange the furniture here. Actually, Mushir and I are shipmates, having sailed on the Free Gaza together just a year ago, on the actual breaking of the siege at that time, the two boats that went through. So we go back a ways. What I'd like to do tonight, I mean, first of all, Ramadan Kareem to everyone. And it was quite a few people, more than I expected, sort of. So what I thought I'd do tonight is not assuming that you all know everything about the conflict or that you've all been to Israel-Palestine. What I thought I'd do within a political context, to kind of walk you through a house demolition. You know, I'm the head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. And the house demolition issue is sort of the essence of the conflict. Since 1967, Israel's demolished more than 24,000 probably more than 35,000, it's hard to tell exactly, Palestinian homes. On the backdrop, of course, of more than 500 Palestinian villages that were demolished inside what became Israel in 1948. So we're really looking at a process of displacement. 1948 continues. Because house demolitions does not only take place in the occupied territories, it also takes place inside Israel against the Arab citizens of Israel. Last year, the Israeli government demolished three times more houses of Israeli citizens inside Israel than it did in the occupied territories. And when I say Israeli citizens, of course, I'm referring to Arab citizens, either Palestinians or Bedouins, and certainly Jewish citizens would never have their houses demolished. So in some ways, 1948 continues. It isn't an episode of the past that's gone. And so in a way, the house demolition issue is the essence of the conflict, because it has to do with one people coming into a country, claiming it exclusively for itself, not even trying to acknowledge that there's another people living there, not recognizing their existence or their historical presence, and basically saying to them, get out, which is what a house demolition policy means. The house demolition process also gives us a window into how the occupation works. So I think you'll find it sort of interesting, as a way in to see how the occupation works, what Israel's intentions are, and so on. And then we can open things up for questions, and I'm here till tomorrow if you want. That's the agenda. Let's begin with a high-tech... Okay. I don't know, can you see this screen? Can you turn these lights off, maybe? In the front, it'll make it easier to see. This is sort of a map that through which you can conceptualize where we're going. No, the other way. These off, and those off. If you can do that. Okay. Well, in that case, there's no point. Might as well keep those lights on. Okay. We'll spend all night talking about lights. So, this is, in a sense, the progression, just to put it in a more visual form. In other words, this was the partition plan of 1947 to partition Palestine. Now, Palestine is really one country. And we're really talking about one country between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. The Palestinians call it Palestine. Jews call it the land of Israel. But everybody really perceives it as one country. All these internal borders are all new and artificial and temporary and don't represent anything. At any rate, in 1947, the United Nations made a decision to partition Palestine between the two peoples, the Jews and the Palestinian Arabs, which brings up a lot of issues I'm not going to get into tonight, like what right did the UN have to do that. But the Palestinians at that time were two-thirds of the population of the country. And they owned, in 1947, about 94% of the land. And yet, in the UN partition, and the Jews, the third of the population that was Jewish, by 1947 had been there maybe 15 or 20 years. In other words, the vast majority of Jews that had come to Palestine in the 1920s and 30s came either fleeing Hitler or fascism in Poland before that time. But it was only in the... Actually, in the mid-20s and early 1930s that you had major immigration waves of Jews into Palestine. So that even the third of the population that was Jewish was a brand new population. And yet, And yet, the Jews got 56% of the land. They got 56% of the land. The Palestinians, who are really the indigenous population, got 42%. Because another 2% was reserved for Jerusalem and Bethlehem that were to be internationalized. So that the partition wasn't really a fair one. And as you can see, it was very artificial. I mean, here, for example, is Jaffa. That's a part of the Arab state, but it's right in the middle of the Jewish. As a matter of fact, in the 56% that the Jews got, half the population was Palestinian Arab. So from the very, very beginning, and I think this is true today, and it's one of the fundamental things we have to deal with, is that the entire concept, and certainly the application of the idea of a Jewish state, simply is unsustainable. It can't work. Because first of all, you're trying to insert an exclusive, ethnically pure state into an area that's populated by another people. The gymnastics that you have to do to try to carve out Jewish areas and Arab areas are impossible because the populations are so intertwined. And in the end, of course, the very idea of a state based on an ethnic basis is something that is not acceptable. I think certainly if Israel is presenting itself as a European or a Western democratic state, that concept is unacceptable. It's racism in a European sense of the term. Any political system, any state that privileges one people over another is racist. And therefore, we have a big discussion inside Israel in the peace camp. Is the problem 1967? In other words, is the problem ending the occupation and having a two-state solution, which of course leaves Israel intact? Or is the problem more fundamental? Is the problem really 1948, 1947? And in fact, we have to rethink this entire enterprise, which I think is the case. At any rate, in 1948, in the war that ensued, the Palestinians did not accept this partition. The Zionist movement did, which made a lot of sense, because if you're a third of the population and you get more than half the land, that's a pretty good deal. The Palestinian Arabs never accepted it. And that's reflected until today, especially by the Hamas position that says, no, we are not going to give up title to 56% or 78% or any percent of our country to another people. So that's used against the Palestinians today, because what you often hear is, you see, the Jews wanted peace, they want a compromise, they wanted two states, and the Arabs always said no. Abba Ibn once said, the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. But if we put this into a colonial framework, into the idea that this is a country of normal people who are living in their country, who own the land, and all of a sudden comes the British, and comes the UN, and comes the Zionist movement and says, well, this country really isn't yours, we're going to take 56% of it away. I mean, no people would agree to that. Certainly the British wouldn't agree to that if that was happening here. So that this whole argument that's used against the Arabs, in a way, I think, has to be turned around. And until today, we have to really understand this conflict, I think, within a colonial perspective. All right, the war happens in 1948. We don't have time to get into the whole history. And at the end of the war, Israel had taken half the land that had been partitioned to the Palestinians. So at the end of the war, Israel emerges on 78% of the country, and the Palestinian areas kind of are reduced to 22%. This is the occupied territories, although, as we know, the Palestinians never took possession of those lands either. Israel, it's very, the actual history. I had an interview with the Jewish Chronicle It's the article came out today in the Jewish Chronicle. I don't know. I haven't seen it, so who knows how it's going to come out. But they're giving you all these slogans all the time, you know. And I say, you know, the real history is much more interesting than all the slogans you can make up. Because in fact, as Avi Shlaim shows, that in fact Israel and Jordan went into the 48 war together. Not exactly as allies, but pretty close to allies. And the agreement even before the war began was this kind of a partition where Israel would take this land and the Jordanian Hashemite kingdom would get what we call today the West Bank and East Jerusalem. So Jordan comes in as an occupying power in 1948. And of course, Egypt took Gaza. So the Palestinians never got, even from the lands that were partitioned to them, never had their own state. And then in 1967, of course, the Six-Day War happens. Israel takes the whole thing. And these become the occupied territories. The occupied territories then constituting 22% of the country. In 1988, the PLO meeting in Algiers, first of all, declares Palestinian independence, and second of all, accepts the two-state solution. So, you know, you often hear about Barak's generous offer at Camp David. Whatever it was, because it's a myth. There was never a generous offer. But you never hear about the Palestinians' generous offer to Israel, which basically says in 1988, 20 years ago, you know, the Palestinians today are half the population of this country. And if refugees return, even some of the refugees from the camps around, the Palestinians will be the majority population. And yet, this majority population said to Israel, we will make peace with you as Israel, and you can have 78% of the country, even though you're the minority, if we can get this less than a quarter of the land that remains for a state of our own. So if, in fact, Israel is looking for peace and security, if this is really what Israel wants, as it keeps telling us, it could have had that 20 years ago. Peace, security, and 78% of the country. And yet Israel said no. So that opens a question here. We have to ask the question, why? What's going on? You know, if peace and security is not the issue, then what is? And what I'm suggesting is that the issue is that Israel wants control of the entire country. It might not, now, there's a fly in the ointment, and that is that, you know, there's almost 4 million Palestinians today in the occupied territories, that we can't digest them, but we also can't throw them out of the country. That would be a little bit too much. So what I'm suggesting is that the political dynamic today is precisely that of apartheid. It's very, very parallel to, with the same logic as South Africa in the days of apartheid. And that is, it's the same problem. The problem that South Africa had, the whites in South Africa, was how do we create a white democracy with a black African majority? And as some of us here remember, what South Africa did was establish 10 Bantustans. It was even a nicer name. They called them homelands. The use of language, which is very prominent also in this conflict. 10 homelands for black Africans on 11% of South African land. In other words, each homeland was about 1%, obviously the most marginal South African land. And then the idea was to shove the black African population into these Bantustans, and now we have a white democracy on 89% of the country. What Israel is trying to do is the same thing. It won't give the Palestinians the 22%, because that's too much. We want to be in control, and therefore, the question is, well, how do we create a Jewish democracy? Because that's, when we're talking, if I'm the Israeli ambassador and I come to Sheffield, I'll talk about Israel's a democracy. the only democracy in the Middle East. At home, in Hebrew, when we talk to each other, Israel is called a Jewish democracy. And it's clear. I mean, you just have to look at the flag and you see that Israel is a country that belongs to a particular people. It doesn't belong to all its citizens, or certainly to all the inhabitants of the country. So it's the same dynamic. How do we create a Jewish democracy on the entire country? Israel has always seen the Jordan River as its eastern security border. So how do we create a Jewish democracy on the entire land of Israel, but somehow get rid of the Palestinian majority? And you get rid of the Palestinian majority by locking it into a Bantustan and it's cantonized. This was Sharon's word. Sharon worked for years on what he called his cantonization plan. You create Palestinian cantons that end up being components of a Bantustan. So you have a canton to the north of the West Bank, all divided by Israeli settlements, a canton in the center, an Israeli-controlled Greater Jerusalem, a canton in the south, and Gaza. And that creates then this kind of a... And then you call it a Palestinian state. You want a two-state solution? Okay, here's a two-state solution. So that the Palestinians get a state, it's not really sovereign, it's not viable, but it's a state, on 15% of the country, and Israel then expands to 85%, and it becomes a Jewish democracy. So this is where Israel's going, and it's doing it in a very sophisticated way. Sometimes I put up this map just for comic effect, because if anybody can tell me how a viable Palestinian state, a two-state solution, is going to emerge from this map, I mean, it's a proposal I'd like to hear. I've never heard a convincing proposal or idea yet. But in effect, Israel has laid over the West Bank what I call a matrix of control. I'm not going to get into the whole thing now. It's complex, it's very interesting, and we have some books out there for sale. We have some books that if you want to read about it. But at any rate...
Commercials aren't allowed.
Okay. I didn't say that. At any rate, what you can see here, just in a word, the 95% of the Palestinians of the West Bank, about 2.5 million people, are locked into these brownish areas. The darker brown are called Area A. And they're the major population centers. You know, Jenin and Nablus and Tul Karm and Qalqilia and the Salfit area, Ramallah, Bethlehem, Hebron, and Jericho and some other places. And the lighter brown areas are Area B. Areas A and B that are supposedly controlled by the Palestinian Authority of Abu Mazen, although we know that Israel invades at will, comprise 22% of the occupied territories. Which means, I'm sorry, that's not true. That's Area A. A and B together are 40%, which means that 60% of the occupied territories are C, which is the gray area here, plus these pinkish areas I'll talk about in a second, that all surround and encompass the Palestinian islands. You can see areas A and B, there's about 70 islands. I mean, look how small some of them are. 70 islands in which Palestinians are confined and completely surrounded by checkpoints. There are more than 600 checkpoints and obstacles to movement within the West Bank. Palestinians can't come into Israel at all, but even moving from island to island becomes very problematic and time-consuming and even dangerous. And then these areas are also surrounded by Israeli settlements. That's all these blue dots here, all through. There's between 150 and 200 Israeli settlements, depending on how you count. 500,000 Israelis live in the occupied territories. And they live in this Area C, so that it's all surrounding these Palestinian cantons. And it's these pink areas in particular that we call the settlement blocks that Israel wants to keep. There are seven of them that control the Jordan River with its water, control the border with Jordan, that divide the West Bank east and west along the city of Ariel in the center here. This block, the Modi'in block, controls Palestinian water, which is underneath here. You have to know what's under the ground to understand the logic as well. There are three settlement blocks that make up what we call Greater Jerusalem that then isolates the eastern part of the city, Palestinian East Jerusalem in the Old City, from the rest of Palestinian society, which is very significant because the World Bank estimates that 40% of the Palestinian economy revolves around Jerusalem. This is where tourism is, which is by far the largest potential Palestinian industry. I mean, the Palestinian state might be small, but they have a state that has Jerusalem and Bethlehem in it. Those are pretty major economic resources. And so the idea of a greater Israeli Jerusalem is that it isolates it and it creates an Israeli presence controlling the whole area. And then there's a salient coming up from the south to Hebron. So now you begin to see the cantons emerging. You see? So there's this canton. Here's the canton in the north. And here's the canton in the center. And here's the canton in the south. And then Gaza. So that the Palestinians might get land, but it's sterile land. All the economic potential of the country is kept by Israel. And so the issue is not a Palestinian state. Israel wants a Palestinian state because it has to get rid of the 4 million people of the West Bank and Gaza. But it wants a Bantustan. And Israel wants to retain control and all the economic resources and potential of the country. So that the issue really is an issue of viability. Can the Palestinians get a viable state? You know, we have to remember, not only will refugees come back here, refugees who are traumatized, who are ill-educated, who many of whom haven't worked for generations, impoverished, a very hard population to integrate, but 60% of the Palestinians are under the age of 18. So if the Palestinians get a state, but it's not a state that has the economic capability of offering a future to its young people, then it's a prison state. It's worse in South Africa. Because in South Africa, the idea was to set up Bantustans that would be reserves of cheap labor that would then work in South Africa. Here, though, Israel has closed the West Bank to workers. Israel's discovered a cheaper source of labor than Palestinians, and that is foreign workers. So you have today in Israel 300,000 workers from China, Thailand, the Philippines, Romania, and West Africa, you see, that are cheaper, and you can get rid of them when you want to. You know, they're all handled by manpower agencies, you know, with some of these issues from here. And therefore, the Palestinians are left with a scorched earth. They have no functioning economy of their own because Israel's destroyed their economy and de-developed the Palestinian areas. What does remain of resources, like Jerusalem or water, is taken by Israel. And then in this scorched earth, Palestinians are prevented. They're not a source of cheap labor that'll work in Israel, but they're prevented from accessing the Israeli economy because Israel has found a cheaper source of labor. So we're really looking at something worse than the apartheid system in South Africa. So that, you know, this is a situation on the ground. And let me take a couple minutes. I don't know if I don't want to keep you too long, but I do want to show you, to kind of go from the level of maps to look at how this thing really works, and look at the issue of house demolitions. Taking one particular family as our example, this is the Shawamri family. Salim, his wife Arabia, and their seven kids. Both of whom are refugees from inside Israel. In other words, their parents came from inside Israel, and in 48 were driven out and settled in the old city of Jerusalem, where Salim and Arabia were born. Then Arabia's family went to Jordan. I won't get into their whole story, but at any rate, Salim is an engineer, worked in Saudi Arabia, got together a nest egg, and when the Oslo peace process began, hoping that peace would come and so on, like thousands of other Palestinians, he went home. And he bought a small piece of land in the village of Anata. Anata is near Jerusalem. And now, but Anata falls in Area C. It wasn't Area C then. It became Area C in 1995. But it was under Israeli control. So like all the Palestinians living in Israeli-controlled areas, he had to turn to the Israeli military authorities of what we call the civil administration. So here's a good use of language. The military administration is called the civil administration to give the sense of proper administration. And, you know, Israel denies that it has an occupation. Okay, maybe.
Ten minutes to go?
We have a timekeeper now. Jeez, he's telling me what to say. He's telling me how much time. The projector's going to go out in a minute. Okay. So, at any rate, so Salim and Arabia then came and bought a small plot of land in Anata and applied to the Israeli authorities and the civil administration for a building permit. And they were denied the permit on the grounds that this is agricultural land. Israel has zoned almost the entire West Bank as agricultural land. And that's how it can prevent Palestinians from building homes. For 42 years now, Palestinians have not been allowed to build homes legally. Not because Israel says you can't build, because that wouldn't be appropriate for a democracy, right? But because this is agricultural land. Now, when we want to build settlements on the same land, and there's a settlement right next door, it's called Maale Adumim, well, we sit on the planning commission, Israelis. So to rezone from agriculture to residential takes a minute. So this is all a good example of how you use planning and zoning and law and administration for political purposes. So they applied three times for a building permit in different ways, as agricultural land, as residential land, as this, and were refused each time. Each time it cost them about £4,000. And finally, like thousands of other Palestinian families, they decided they had to simply build a house, even without a permit. I mean, they had nowhere to live, the family's growing, and so they built a modest house on land that they owned. They got a demolition order, but they lived for 5 years in the home. I can't say relaxed and secure, because any moment bulldozers could come, but they lived for 5 years in the home before they came. And there are thousands of Palestinian families that live in that daily anxiety of, are the bulldozers going to come in the morning? There are tens of thousands of demolition orders outstanding. In East Jerusalem alone, which if you've been there is not a very large area, the Palestinian part of Jerusalem, there alone there are 22,000 demolition orders, just in East Jerusalem. So that this is the experience of tens of thousands of Palestinian families. Finally, one day in July 1998, Salim and his family are having lunch, and there's a knock on the door. Salim opens the door, sees the house surrounded by soldiers, And these two guys are officials of the civil administration. They're civilians, not exactly harmless civilians. I don't know what civil servants look like in Sheffield, but this is what civil servants look like in the West Bank. This is Rami, and this is Micha. And they're very well known because they're like warlords. You know, they come through these villages in their white jeeps. They can come into your house if you're a Palestinian with no, they can just come into your house. They barge in with soldiers because you're not allowed to add a bathroom in the corner of your house without a permit from the Israeli authorities. You're not allowed to plant a garden in front of your door without a permit from Israeli authorities. The Bedouins are not allowed to pitch tents without building permits. The degree of control is so intricate and so invasive that it's very hard to convey. And these guys are that physical manifestation of that control. They're in your face all the time. There are school children, kindergarten kids, who draw pictures of these of the white jeeps. They become like these monster figures in their lives. So Rami says to Salim, "Is this your house?" Salim says, "Yes, it's my house." He says, "No, it isn't. It's our house. You got 15 minutes to get all your belongings out. We're going to demolish it." So what would you do? I mean, your home really is your sacred space, your most intimate space. You wouldn't say, "Dear, would you please help me take the table out?" You would protest. You would yell. You would something. And when you do that, it turns into resistance. Here's where the soldiers come in. Salim was beaten and thrown out of his house. In all the commotion, Arabiya, his wife, managed to slam the door shut and lock it with her and her kids inside. So the soldiers then broke the windows of the house. The soldiers broke the windows of the house and threw tear gas into the house to flush them out. Now, I don't know if you've ever had a whiff of tear gas outside. It's pretty powerful. Imagine inside your home. Then they broke in the house. The kids ran screaming and crying in all directions. And Arabiya was carried out unconscious and was later taken to a hospital in Jordan. She didn't speak for 2 months. And the trauma you can still see in her and the kids. Maybe I'll mention that in a minute if I have time. Now we come into the act. We're the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. And with other Israeli activists, if we can get there in time, we resist the demolition of Palestinian homes. We get in front of bulldozers. We chain ourselves in houses. We do everything we can. We call journalists to come. We call diplomats to come. And we resist the demolitions. This is Rabbi Arik Asherman, who's a rabbi, the head of a group called Rabbis for Human Rights. 100 Israeli rabbis that fight the policy of house demolitions. Finally, the family's out of the house, we're out of the house, and the civil administration sends in foreign workers to rip out all the furniture. You know, you only have a few minutes. So this is a worker from Romania. And you know how your furnishings are. You know, you have a bedroom set, and the bedboard is screwed on to the night table, which is screwed to the bed, and you know, you don't carefully unscrew. Everything is torn out. The kitchen appliances. I mean, everything is a complete ruin, as you can see. Papers are flying. Imagine what you have in your home. Your papers, your family photos, your kids' toys. Everything is just thrown out. And then the bulldozer comes. So what the civil administration does is subcontracts to commercial wrecking companies. You know, if you have a company and you own a bulldozer, you put a tender in, you put a bid in for a contract to demolish houses. So here there's a kind of a tragedy that begins to expose a little bit what happens. The driver of the bulldozer is a Palestinian. He's just a guy that works for this company. So he reports to work in the morning, and the boss says, you're going to go build a road. Comes to work the next morning, the boss says, you're going to go demolish houses. I got a contract to demolish houses. You know, so it's very easy for us to say, well, he should say no. But, you know, if you're a Palestinian with six kids, jobs aren't exactly abundant, you know, and you're put in that kind of a situation. And he knew Salim. I mean, they knew each other. So you can imagine what's going on in his mind. The bulldozer comes in through the garden. Now, if you look here, you can begin to see the agricultural land around. Salim says this wasn't farmed since Adam. So that all that is simply a legal fiction, but it comes in through the garden and the home is demolished. And it's a complete, of course, a complete ruin. Even on top of some of the furniture that wasn't taken out. This is Salim's neighbor, Mahmoud Dandis, who lives in this house, and his home was demolished about a year and a half ago. So what we do as the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions is we mobilize Israeli peace activists, we work with Palestinians, we always work through Palestinian organizations. Internationals come. There are some people here tonight that have been with us in rebuilding. And we go out and rebuild Palestinian homes as political acts of resistance. This is not humanitarian work. It's political. And we're partners and we're junior partners of the Palestinians that we work with. So, first of all, you see here a tent. The Red Crescent Society gives the family a tent to live in when their home is demolished. I mean, this happens to be in July, but you can imagine in December, January, where it's cold, it's rainy, and it often snows in this part of the country, living with your family in a tent. And we go out and rebuild in a very demonstrative way. We raise money from people like you, and your time will come. We've built about 165 homes over the last 10 years. Now, that's a drop in the bucket if you're thinking about it humanitarian-wise. Big deal, 165 homes out of 24,000. But if you look at them as 165 political acts of resistance of Israelis and Palestinians together, and this is civil disobedience because it's illegal to rebuild homes, then I think it really means much more. And we come together as Israelis and Palestinians. It takes us a few weeks or more to rebuild homes. So it's not just going out and holding up a sign or doing something symbolic and going back. We actually build and we get to know each other. And these are real acts of solidarity. Here's Arabia between two Israeli women rebuilding her house. So I think it's not only solidarity, but there's a real support for Palestinian families that are intimidated, scared, ruined financially, and able to do something like rebuilding their home. We work, as I said, through Palestinian organizations. For example, the Palestinian Land Defense Committee is one of our partners. And we finished the house. But I had a feeling they're going to come back to demolish again. Because, you know, houses can be redemolished. A demolition order is forever. And it doesn't matter if you move a house to another spot or something, the demolition order is forever. So that we slept over. Sure enough, 4:30 in the morning, the soldiers come, the bulldozers come. You can see it's still, the scaffolding is still wet. We had just poured the concrete for the roof the night before. And the house was demolished for the second time. And Salim's face says it all. In other words, we didn't even manage to drink our morning coffee yet, and the house was gone. So we decided we're going to rebuild again. We are not going to let the occupation win. So we went out to rebuild the house another time. Israelis, Palestinians. And again, we do it in a very open way. We try to get press coverage. We try to really make this as public as possible. And we managed to build a small house again. The family moved in. Salim and Arabia moved in. The next morning, the civil administration came back. And here you can see the white jeeps that are so well known in Palestinian communities all over. And just to show you what the civil administration means, this sign in the windshield here, or you call it something else in Britain, the windscreen, it says Tzahal, which is the IDF, the Israeli army. So it's clear that this is really a military operation under the guise of being civilian. Again, we resist. Again, Yizmicha comes. The furniture is thrown out of the house, this time by workers from West Africa. The bulldozer arrives again. And this time they sent a pneumatic drill, a caterpillar drill, in order to drill up the, to dig up the foundations of the house so that it couldn't be rebuilt again. And Salim says, you know, the demolition of a home is really the demolition of a family. You know, for a man, men, women, and children have very different reactions. For a man, you can imagine it's humiliating, it's emasculating. A man can't protect his family. The father is humiliated before his children, financially ruined, and most important, he can't offer shelter to his family anymore. You can't just go get another house. So that for men, it's a tremendous trauma. For women, it's a double trauma. Because most Palestinian women don't work outside. For them, the home is their domestic sphere. It's what defines them as women, as mothers, as wives. So when a woman loses that, all of a sudden, she often becomes very disoriented. You know, she doesn't have her space anymore. You know, the kids are all scattered. The kids are traumatized. I mean, she doesn't have any facilities, any way to deal with this new reality. Often women go into a state of mourning. Arabia, like I said, didn't speak for 2 months after this. And then, eventually, what happens is you have to move into the home of another woman, either your sister-in-law or your mother-in-law's home. Now, you're moving in with eight kids. Not for a weekend, but open-ended. So this creates tensions. Now you're in another woman's space, and as much solidarity as there might be, it begins to wear thin when you have a small house with 15, 20 people living in it. So the wife begins to urge the husband to do something. The husband is powerless to do anything. It really creates tremendous tensions within the home and even domestic violence. I mean, it's a terrible thing that's happening to tens of thousands of Palestinian families. And then the kids are traumatized as well. This is Ashraf, who was 16 at the time, who quit school and had to get a job to help support his family in their financial straits. This is their daughter, Lina. Lina, what happened was when the family, it was getting intolerable, and we feel responsible for the families we work with, so that we help them to rent to rent an apartment. They can't live in the house because it's now in Area C and they have Jerusalem residency, so we help them rent an apartment. But the apartment is very in the northern part of Jerusalem, very close to Ramallah. So in the Intifada, the second Intifada, Israeli jets were coming low over the house to shoot into Ramallah. Helicopters, you know, Apache helicopter shooting missiles. Tanks were going through their neighborhood to get to Ramallah and so on. And Lina, you know, the kids were terrified. You know, we talk about terrorism. I mean, this is terrorism. The kids are terrified. They're throwing up. You know, and given the experience they had with the demolitions. So Salim came to Lena and the kids and said, it's okay, I'm here, I'll protect you. And Lena said to him, you can't protect us. We saw what the soldiers did to you when they demolished our house. You can't protect us. And Salim says, imagine the feelings of a father when his daughter can't believe that he could protect her. Or Wafa. Wafa, in this whole period, when the jets were coming in and so on, went blind. She went blind. And Salim called me in a panic, and we took her to the hospital, and her sight came back. And it was a form of kind of a hysterical blindness. But you know, you can imagine the trauma a kid is going through when their mind shuts down, causing even a temporary kind of a blindness. And so on. So that the house is demolished again. And I just have a couple, I'm going to round this up. Anyway, we went out again. We rebuilt the home. We've rebuilt the home now 3 times. The fourth home is standing. It's called Beit Arabiya. It still has a demolition order. Salim has gone twice to the Israeli Supreme Court to try to rescind the demolition order that really has no right to be there. And in fact, Israel and international law has no right to demolish homes. But at any rate, the house still stands. It's called Beit Arabiya, and it has a mural on the side. This is at the dedication of the last building of the house. A dead caterpillar bulldozer amidst a pile of dead armaments. You can see, it's hard to see in the background, but there's Arab, Jewish, and international workers working together, marching together in solidarity with the red flag and so on. And hovering over the whole scene are the figures of two women who died in house demolitions. One of them, as you know, was the American woman Rachel Corrie, who died when a bulldozer ran over her twice when she was standing in front of a Palestinian home in Gaza. And the other woman is a Palestinian woman named Nuha Swaydan, who was from Gaza, who was killed about 2 weeks before Rachel, a pregnant woman, the mother of 10 children, who was killed in her bed at night when her house was demolished on top of her. So that these are the two women that sort of the house is dedicated to. So, all right, without going into to more details, of course, we also have the wall that's being built. And I won't go into the wall right now. But where we're going then is toward this sort of a Bantustan. And this is what we have to try to prevent. There's a question, we can talk about this in the question and answers. Is a two-state solution still viable? What's Obama going to do? And if not, then where should we be going as well? So I'll leave it at that.